Well, all right, gentlemen, tell us who you are first, and we'll get into our first, and I think our only interview for this morning.
Hi, I'm Chris Albert, Vice President and Communications Director for Music Monday of the Ozarks.
And I'm Michael Cochran, author, musician, retired wild man.
Yeah, and a radio veteran, too.
Yes, a radio veteran.
Now,
yes.
Music Monday of the Ozarks has been around for how long?
5 years we're going on. This
seems like it's been longer than that. It's like, yeah.
Yep. It's 5 years. I forget the time that we started, but we started out at the dugout. And it was all started by Jim Wunderly, Brian Fogel, and Robin Luke, who kind of got together and with some other gentlemen, and they got together to discuss albums, their album collection and the music and all that stuff. And then next thing I know, they invited Robin Luke to talk about his career. And Robin Luke is who is a rock star in his own genre. He did a song called Susie Darling back in the late 50s, 60s.
Somewhere around 1958 to 60. He'll correct us if we're wrong.
Thank you, Robin. And he got involved with the rock and roll era as it was starting to go out. He's traveled and played with everybody from Johnny Cash to the Everly Brothers.
Oh, he did numerous Dick Clark American Bandstand episodes and around that time.
If you watch late night and watch the old 50s rock and roll things where they're selling CDs, they'll show him in his picture and stuff like that.
Of course, he was here at MSU as a professor for a long time.
Yeah, marketing and stuff like that.
Yep, in the marketing department.
And then next thing you know, they called me. Well, Lloyd Hicks was greatly involved in this in the very beginning. He actually started because he had a record collection of about 1,000 albums or something. And next thing I know, they called me and said, hey, we want to hear about the Finley River Rock Festival. So that's how it really started. And next thing you know, people started coming and listening to the stories.
Basically, that's what it's all about. The first Monday of each month, you invite people who are in the music or the broadcasting or music publishing, just somehow either directly or peripherally involved in the music business, and they come and they talk about their involvement in the music business in the Ozarks.
Yeah, you yourself and Mike Smith were there.
Mike Smith and I did it a couple of years ago, yeah.
And we have everybody from the symphony conductor talking about that, which was just one of our best. We all feel like it was one of our best. And then we have people from the early years of the Ozark Jubilee who are still with us, and different types of different music. And, of course, we have Michael Cochran we have today, and he's not only a great storyteller and a musician, songwriter, but he's also an author of books.
And now, one of the things that we're doing today is to alert people through its entire history. It's been a lunchtime thing on the first Monday of the month, and it's been taking place at University Plaza in the John Q. Hammond's room. And as of Monday, June 3rd will be the next one, and it'll inaugurate a new evening series.
Right.
You're moving it to 6 p.m. on the first Monday of the month.
Right. This is a new thing. We have found that a lot of people want to come. They want to come and listen and be a participant of it. And, of course, you know, getting off for lunch is kind of a little difficult. Yeah, we did have a buffet that was offered, but it was lots of people come and they have to leave or something like that. So we thought, let's move it to the evenings. We have had the cooperation of the University Plaza helping us out, who have been really great throughout the whole thing.
Yeah,
kind of helping as a co-host. And of course, KSMU has been a great support. And we're going to try this. We're not going to have the food, but we will have a refreshment bar where people can get drinks, Cokes, and refreshments and other libation type situations.
Right.
But we're encouraging. There is no, it doesn't cost anything. It is free. We do accept donations. That's what keeps us going. And also, we have our own website, which is www.musicmondayoftheozarks.com. Now, the key to all this is actually we are working with the Springfield Historic Museum, and we're archiving by filming all these events. And eventually, we will be opening up a kiosk in the theater, the Fox Theater, where people can come in and access different theaters. And they'll be able to check out all the history from going back to the 20s and 30s up to pretty much, I'd say, the 90s. You know, we're not going, we're not getting too much into the future because we always believe that, you know, you're judged by
your past.
Your past.
Yeah,
and
really.
Your accomplishments of what you've done in a very definitive industry, the music industry. And like Randy said, it's got everything from broadcasting to film to music, concerts, producers.
Authorship.
Authorship.
You know, right.
I think a lot of people don't realize how significant Springfield has been to the overall musical history of the country.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This was a crossroads, a major crossroads in the early days of broadcasting.
I'm always amazed that when I hear certain stories from people, I just go, my word, I didn't know that. It was, especially when they come in and talk about instrumentations, or you go back, we just had the Chapmans who were talking about their
yes.
whole career and everything.
That
like
was
that.
A great show.
That
really
was a great show. We've had oh, I just can't even think of all the different people that we've had who have told stories that I'm just amazed that, oh, I never knew that.
Exactly.
I didn't know that. Wow, that really happened? So
yeah.
And we're hoping that more people take more interest and start coming to our evening shows. Now, we are, you know, trying to make sure that this expands and we get more people and stuff like that. And we're encouraging
that's
more.
That's the main reason you're moving to the evening, yeah.
And one nice thing about having it in the evening, from at least from my perspective as your next presenter, you know, when it was done at noon, you really were pretty much limited to the 1 hour.
Right.
And I know you've told me the program should be 1 hour. But if it runs a little over...
Well, there's always question and answer afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's
and that can get pretty lively.
Yeah, that's what opens the door. Yeah. And we found that that's really great. And there won't be the pressure to get out or people go
right.
back to work. You know,
yeah.
they can stay and they can talk. And then even if we stop the filming, there's opportunities
and
to
another
discuss.
Difference I noted with the Chapmans is they actually did a couple of tunes.
Yes. Yeah. Now,
I don't know if you're encouraging that or
no,
not.
No, we're more interested in the story. You know, music, I agree, but then we don't always have the
well, you were limited for time, yeah.
Well, we're limited, but we're also capabilities of setting up and
sure.
getting a true sound.
Yeah.
As a technician and a sound guy and everything, it takes a lot of work to be able to get that and get the right sound. You should know that even
oh,
your
oh, absolutely.
Friday shows
oh, yeah.
setting up. And it takes a lot of time. Now, we are limited as far as the hotel, you know. We can use the room for an hour, maybe 2 hours. But, you know, it is difficult to do the sound.
Duly noted.
But if people want to play after we're done shooting, turning down the camera, that's fine. I have no problems. We have no problems with that. It's just I feel like if I can't get a really good sound and really show with the
It's not really worth anybody's time and effort to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hope that they go hear somebody. It's like after you do some of these, you encourage people to go out to the
absolutely.
Alamo, and it's much, you know, even though you do guys do great job.
But it's just different hearing people in a live venue.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, all right. Michael Cochran will inaugurate the evening series of Music Monday in the Ozarks. Not your first rodeo time in the rodeo as far as
no.
talking for before that group. But this will be Monday, June the 3rd at 6 p.m. again at University Plaza in the John Q. Hammond's room. Refreshments provided, free and open to the public. And Michael has a long history. Now, a lot of us remember Michael from his years at KGBX Radio. You started there in 1982, is that
maybe
right?
Maybe it was late 81.
Okay.
I remember moving in to the house we'd rented on Thanksgiving Day, 1981. So,
and you were from the area. You were from West Plains
I'm
area.
I'm a West Plains boy.
Yeah,
I'm
a zizzer.
I'm a zizzer. I'm proud of it, too.
Right.
Never
but
heard that before.
I'm a Howell County boy, just like Randall Chowning. well, he came from Mountain View. You know.
Hey, Jennifer's, you know, she's from
West
the
Plains.
West Plains yeah. area, too. So there you go.
Yeah. Great, great place down in there. I love Howell County.
Produced a lot of good people, Porter Wagner and people like
yep.
that. Yeah.
Now, you, of course, in the 80s, and I'm not sure how late you were at KGBX. I can't remember how.
I'm the guy that Remember when it went dark?
That's right.
I'm the guy that pushed the button and knocked it off the air.
I've got the video that OPT did. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You were the one that turned the lights out in the old building on Boonville.
Actually, that time, that terrible day, because KGBX had been on the air for 60 years.
Yes. And the only local station longer than that was KWTO, and they were co-owned at that time, back in the 30s and 40s
and 50s.
And,
those two stations are going to come into play when we start talking about these two characters that I'm familiar with.
See, that's the thing with Michael. He's got – I mean, you may also know him from his entrepreneurship, Nellie Dunn's Antiques and Vintage Clothing on Commercial Street. You've definitely heard him on numerous radio and TV commercials over the years. You were a head writer and – the broadcast media producer at Wanamaker Advertising.
Yeah, for over 20 years.
Yeah. But people don't, people may not realize that you, ever since you were a kid, have been a musician.
Yes. I was a pretty well-known musical persona up in central Missouri, where I went to Mizzou, came out of Mizzou, banged around the country, wound up at KFRU doing morning drive for a number of years.
Up in Columbia, yeah.
But when I came to Springfield to work at KGBX and be music director at KGBX and eventually program director there, I decided to kind of keep my musical side.
Your proclivities.
Yeah, I kind of off to the side. I didn't want to – for one thing, I knew if the station owners knew – what I did, they'd be trotting me out there all the time, and I didn't want to be a geek, So, and I don't know if that was a good or bad move, but yeah, I'm a guitar player, songwriter, and a longtime performer.
That's how I met Michael. Actually, we were doing jams out at Lake Springfield in 67, 68, and a friend came up and said, "Hey, these guys are traveling through. Would you mind if they came out and play?" And he played in a band called The Sound Farm, which was a pre-Daredevil, they were really, really good. And sure, bring them on out. And they showed up, and we had this great jam out there.
Yeah. That was April of 1969, actually.
Oh. Well, the great story regarding the guitar is you and your two older brothers making a trip to Nashville. You were, 15 or 16 years of age?
I was 16. It actually started, excuse me, I think I was about 12 years old. I was playing the ukulele. And 12 years old would put us into 1956. And we had one radio station in West Plains,
KWPM.
Or as they would say down there, KW.
Yeah, KWPM.
AM and FM. And one day I was sitting in the Model Drugstore at the soda fountain there in West Plains, minding my own business. And on the back bar behind the soda fountain was an old Bakelite radio. And it was tuned to KWPM because that was – you could get KWTO at night.
But it was noisy in the daytime.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, and KWPM was 1,000 watts daytime, 250 after sundown, and went off the air at 11.
At 11, okay.
It was a daytimer. And I heard a sound come out of that radio that I'd never heard before. And it was Chet Atkins.
Yes.
And I believe the song he was playing was Poor People of Paris, or it might have been Mr. Sandman. But it galvanized me. I wasn't thinking about anything. But when I heard that sound, I asked the soda jerk who it was. He said, "That's Chet Atkins." And that just changed my life. I got a guitar and started trying to learn to play like Chet, which, of course, I was never able to fully do. We got a couple of his albums, and my two brothers jumped in there with me, and we all three became guitar nuts. And it was kind of good because there was a lot of competition among the three of us to see who could figure out some of Chet's licks and so forth. And yeah, in 1960, I was 16 years old. Both my brothers were off to college. I was still in high school. And that December, they came home on break, and we talked to our parents into letting us take the family car and drive to Nashville to meet Chet. That was our reason for going, to meet Chet. We had written Chet a letter and said we wanted to come and meet him. And he wrote back a personal letter and said, "Why, sure. Let me add right here.
Okay.
We were from West Plains. And at the time these things were happening, Porter Wagoner, also from West Plains, was one of the top country acts in the country and making a ton of money for
nationally
RCA.
Syndicated show every week. Yeah,
and he was selling a lot of records for RCA, and Chet was his producer.
Right.
So we would always say, we're the Cochran brothers from West Plains.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's the thing. You know, people may not remember that or may not be aware. You know, you think of Chet as a master fingerstyle guitarist, but he was the main music producer and director at RCA's Nashville studio. Yeah.
He was head of Nashville operations for RCA.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable, but he would be producing 30 to 40 artists at the same time.
I mean, I don't doubt it.
And he still was obligated to release two albums a year for RCA.
Plus, he was also touring.
Yeah.
Performing
hanging
live.
Here a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was a lot of stress. He never really wanted to be a record producer. He just really wanted to play guitar. Mm. But anyway, he wrote us back and said, sure, come on down, boys. I'll be glad to meet you. So we drove down there. And as it turned out, we walked into the Studio B office. We'd already learned that Chet's secretary's name was Mary, so we walked in and said, "Hi, Mary." she looked at us like, "Should I know?
Should I know you?"
Said, "We're the Cochran brothers from West Plains. We're here to see Chet." And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Chet's in Minneapolis."
Oh no!
And I mean, the stricken look on our faces was such that she was concerned. She said, "Well, did you have an audition? No. Did you have an appointment? No." And she felt so sorry for us that she said, "Well, I'll tell you what. He's coming in on the plane Sunday afternoon. If you'll be out at the airport at such and such a time, you can talk to him when he gets off the plane." So, okay. We were crestfallen.
But you had not made a formal appointment.
No.
Yeah, okay.
No. And the reason he was gone to Minneapolis is that one of his records was getting a whole lot of airplay up there. So RCA said, why don't you go on up there
and do some promotion.
Do some smoothing.
Yeah.
But we had the most wonderful time in Nashville waiting for him to get there. There was this show called the Friday Night Frolics, which was like a junior Opry. You know, it wasn't in the Ryman.
Right.
But we went to that and we met all kinds of great people. Met Odell Martin and Jackie Phelps and Leo Jackson, who was Jim Reeves' lead guitar player. And these people were so accessible. You just walk up to them and
they didn't think of themselves as stars. They were very unprepossessing.
But one of my favorite stories is that we went to the Opry on Saturday night. Hmm. And, of course, it was in the Ryman. And instead of going in the front door, we walked down this alley beside the Ryman toward the back of the building. And there were the stage doors, a couple of double doors, were propped open because it was hot in there, even though it was December. And there was a big old pot-bellied guard there in his guard uniform, just standing there guarding the door, you know. And we were kind of starting to put the schmooze on him. You know, we're the Cochran brothers from West Plains. And just about that time, we saw Lester Flatt walk by. Mm. They were on the Opry that night.
Yeah.
And we saw him walk by the open door, and my brother Russ said, "Hi, Lester." And Lester turned and went. And then the guard went, "Go on in, boys." So we got backstage at the Opry. And
just because Lester was acknowledging a fan, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, he may look like he knew you, though.
Lester, and he did a little salute. He was all dressed up in his white suit with his hat and everything. So there we are backstage at the Opry and at the Ryman. And the backstage area was this catacomb of little concrete cells. I mean, just little bare concrete rooms. Maybe you're with a chair, maybe not. But all the acts would go into these rooms and get tuned up and, you know, make sure they knew what they were going to do when they went on the stage.
Right.
Because, as you know, the Opry, man, that thing, you know, there was not a wasted second on that show.
Well, that's what I loved when I worked for the Presleys, that whole show type aspect. It's just boom, 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 yeah. boom, boom.
So we got to, we just roamed around back there, and at the we were dressed. We had Pendleton jackets. Do you remember?
Oh yes,
Pendleton jackets,
sure.
kind of like a sport coat, mm-hmm. a jacket. And different plaid patterns. Well, we each had Pendleton jacket.
Okay.
They were a different plaid design, but, you know. And when people looked at us, they
you look like
they said, we're the Cochran brothers. We must, yo, you guys going to be on tonight? No. But, I mean, I met Johnny Cash that night, met Hank Garland that night. The great, I mean, I guess you have to be a, pretty deep into guitar players to know who Hank Garland was, but he was a great guitar player. And Chet was supposed to have played that night. In fact, his name was on the program, but he wasn't there, so Hank Garland filled in for him. And Hank had this standing gig at a jazz club, Printer's Alley,
mm-hmm.
in
oh, yeah.
Nashville.
Oh, sure.
At the Carousel Club, and he invited us to come down as his guests. He played a set. We were sitting there at the bar, and I'm 16 years old, and they're serving me without question. And he came up and said, "Well, I'm glad you boys made it." I said, "How do you like us?" "Oh," I said, "You're great, Hank. What do you think about Chet?"
I mean, enough about you. Let's talk about Chet.
Yeah, right. And he was so gracious, and we had the most wonderful time there.
Now, you maintained a friendship. You developed a friendship with Chet and maintained a friendship with him.
Yes,
and
I did. All three of us did.
In 2001, you published a biography that you wrote of Chet mm-hmm. Atkins. Yeah. Chet Atkins, Me and My Guitars.
Yes. That's right. I got one more little anecdote. I know we're probably limited on time. I want to tell you this one little anecdote.
Okay.
It will show you how mesmerized we were. I mean, when Chet came off that airplane, and of course there was no, you know, he came down the steps, came walking across the pavement, came in the door, and we were standing there like buzzards, you know, waiting for him.
Circling for it, yeah.
Eddie Arnold was with him. He and Eddie Arnold were together.
Okay.
And the oldest brother, Russ Cochran, stepped up and said, "Are you Chet Atkins?" Of course, we knew he was, but we had to start the conversation somehow. And Chet said, "Yes, I am." And he set down his suitcase. And he knew who we were when we told him. He said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed you boys." And he stood there and talked to us for 15 or 20 minutes. Eddie Arnold got impatient and left. I never really liked Eddie Arnold after that. But here's the funny thing. We're standing there talking to Chet, and right behind us was this, like, short flight of stairs, maybe three or four steps, where the floor level in the airport changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Went down. So we're standing there talking to Chet, and right behind me, a little old lady trips and falls down the stairs.
Oh.
And as one, we all turned, looked at the lady laying on the floor, and just turned right back to Chet and didn't make a move to help her.
Geez.
Other people did, but I mean, that's just how it just represents. I was numb. This guy was my hero, man.
But how cool to actually get to know him and to eventually write a biography of him.
And the thing is that he was so gracious. Who wouldn't have said, after he was tired, he'd been on the plane, he wanted to get home, he said, "I'm sorry, boys, I got to get home. Maybe we'll see you some other time." He didn't do that.
He stood there and talked to you.
I'll never forget, he shook each of our hand, and he looked you right in the eye when you shook your hand. He said, "Now you're Mike, and you're Rick, and you're Russ." And the amazing thing was, the next time we saw him a short time later, He remembered
who you were.
I mean, you can't, you know, it's hard to express how deeply meaningful that was. But yes, we would see Chet often after that. And he was always just so kind. And he never introduced us as fans. He would always say, "These are my friends from Missouri."
Yeah.
I mean, it was just wonderful. So yes, you know, there was a so-called biography of Chet that was published in the 70s, I think, called Country Gentleman. And it was a total
a hack job.
It was a hack job. Mm-hmm. It was a pot boiler. He didn't like it. There was all sorts of inaccurate information in it. His family hated it. And, you know, Chet came from the Clinch Mountain region of East Tennessee, which is very, very much like right here.
Mm-hmm.
Just you get out in that part of the country, you'd think you were in the Ozarks. It's so similar.
Right.
And I had, my brother had published, and I had been the editor of a magazine called the West Plains Gazette, which was all about the history of Howell County and the surrounding area. Remember when Dr. Morrow did that multimedia presentation that he traveled around the Ozarks with the multiple slide projectors? We were featured in that. And we sent copies of our magazine to Chet. He loved it. It resonated with his own childhood. And one day when he expressed his discontent with that biography, the idea was born to do a book about him telling the story of his career through his guitars. You know, how did you get this guitar? What did it mean to you? You know, yes.
And each story inspired a new story. And yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yes, my brother published it. I wrote it. And it was published in 2001. And it's a niche book, but it was a hit.
And then just 4 years later, you wrote a biography of Les Paul in his own words.
Yes.
2005.
Yes.
As well as books about Hopalong Cassidy,
William Boyd,
mm-hmm. and singer-songwriter Don McLean.
Yes.
Not too long ago, you published a book about him.
I think that was 2012 when mm-hmm. we published that one.
Well, you know, listening to Michael, that kind of goes with what Music Monday of the Ozark is about.
Yeah.
You know?
I was hoping you know, don't waste too many of your stories on us. We'll, you know, save some of them for Monday the 3rd.
But the story, to tell the story, I you know, it's great for the music side, but lots of times you don't really hear about the people or their personality and what they were.
Yeah.
And especially, like he said, the older musicians and these gentlemen from the past, you could go up and talk to them. I met so many people. Carl Perkins I met while doing a show, and he was just this nicest person I could ever believe. And Three Dog Night, it has changed considerably these days, where now you have guards.
Yeah.
And I used to be able to get backstage.
You simply can't have access like that
anymore.
I'd
have a case of beer and say, here, I brought this for you, the band and stuff, and they'd let you in and you'd talk. I met so many musicians and people big times just because they were nice and everything. And that's what I love about Music Monday, is it opens up that mystery that everybody kind of thinks about, and then you get the real true stories. And that's why we're doing Music Monday of the Ozarks.
Right. And, you know, both Chester and Lester have connections in Springfield.
Oh, yeah.
I think people are more familiar with Chet's story that
at KWTO.
He became a staff musician at KWTO in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Cy Simon was the one who convinced him to start calling himself Chet. He'd billed himself as Chester Atkins. For a while, he was Chester Atkins and his talking guitar. So Chet's daughter was born here, and he hated to leave when he went to Nashville, I think, in 1950.
I think a lot of people hated to see a lot of those people leave.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Jubilee was quite the – I remember watching it up in Iowa on my grandfather's farm. I mean, Saturday night, it was – everybody be quiet. He turned that show on, and that's what you watched. And
yeah.
That's how I cut my teeth on it. It was – was 5-year-old, 6-year-old sitting
sure.
watching this going, whoa.
The fewer people know the Les Paul aspect in Springfield, though. When he was 16 years, both Chet and Les were high school dropouts.
Hmm.
And Les was playing full-time and touring when he was 16 years old. And his moniker at that time was Rhubarb Red. Les did, when he was young, he had that shocking red hair.
Flaming red hair.
I mean, he was a firehead. And he had a duo going with an older man who was a really good guitar player, a fellow named Sonny Joe Wolverton. And when Ralph Cox bought KGBX, which at the time was in St. Joseph, I believe, and decided to move it
down
to Springfield
here.
Mm-hmm. And make it a sister station to KWTO.
Or Ralph Foster, actually.
Ralph Foster, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I get my famous men mixed up. Thank you. I knew that wasn't right. Mr. Foster hired them to come down here, and he wanted some real talent on KGBX when it first went on the air. I believe KGBX went on the air Christmas Day, 1933, I think. I know it was Christmas Day. I might have the year off.
I believe that's right.
And Les and Sonny Joe were known as the Ozark Apple Knockers. And Les was just a 16-year-old kid.
But he was a geek. Nobody ever knew that. He did for the recording industry.
Oh,
multi-tracking. You know, the delay stuff.
He virtually invented all that stuff.
And the story I've heard is he would sit in the hotel room of the Colonial and sit there and play and do these, work with this stuff and come up with these ideas and things.
He was thinking about it, for
now,
sure.
How long was he here?
They were here less than a year.
Yeah.
But when I met Les in early 2002 or 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah, the book came out in 2005.
Yes.
It took three years to write.
But we went up to his home in Mahwah, New Jersey, and knocked on his door, and he came to the door and let us in, and we went in and sat down. And he's in his 80s now.
At that point, yeah.
Yes. And so he said, well, where are you boys from? All he knew about us was that we'd send him a copy of this beautiful book about Chet and then ask him if he'd like a similar book about himself. Mm. And, you know, Les did have a big ego.
Sure.
So he said, why, sure. Bring it on, boys. And so many people, that we had a lot of friends in the guitar world through Chet, and so many people said, oh, boys, you'll never be able to get along with Les. He'll walk all over you, and if he can't walk all over you, he'll turn his back on you, you know? Well, it didn't turn out to be that way at all.
Uh-uh.
But one of the keys to getting off on the right foot with him was when he asked, where are you boys from?
Right.
I said, well, I'm from Springfield, Missouri. And his eyes opened up, and he said, whoa, yeah. Springfield, Missouri, is KWTO still on the air?
Of course.
It sure is. Yeah. He said, I put that place on the air.
Yeah.
He was, and it was all true.
Oh, I met him in New York at his club, and when I said Springfield, it was...
That was the first thing he thought, yeah.
You were welcome into the door.
Yeah.
I mean,
As young as he was, it was a good memory for him to have been here. And so I just had a wonderful time getting to know Les. And, you know, when we were first starting out, I would go up to his home and stay 5 days usually. He would wear me out. You know this, Randy. Interviewing takes a lot of energy,
actually. It does.
You know, and I would sit there with him for 3 or 4 or 5 hours talking and tape recorder going and my notes and making notes. And after a while, I'd say, Les, I'm getting tired. I'm going to go back to my motel room. And he'd say, oh, you girls getting tired? I said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. And he would immediately get up and start doing something.
Mm.
You know, he was still working on inventions.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he was just...
And even with the arthritis, he was still out playing.
Oh, he was amazing.
I mean, and watch him play, there was this little three-piece.
He stayed up all night, every night, and he wouldn't receive us until 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm.
Yeah.
That was as early as we could get in.
Yeah.
But during those early interviews, I started asking him about Mary. I mean, people know about Les Paul and Mary Ford than they do about Les Paul as an individual.
Right.
And he said, oh, I asked him a question about Mary, and he just kind of closed his mouth and looked off in the other direction.
Yeah. And I said, it was a pretty sore point with him.
Yeah, because he'd gotten a lot of bad press for the way he allegedly treated Mary. And I said, I repeated the question, and he said, no, well... That'll have to be for some other book. What? But after time went by, I gained his trust, and he told me everything about Mary and a lot of things that are not in the book that I'll never tell. But the point is, I gained his trust, and Les had had a lot of abuse in the press.
Yeah.
because he did have a big ego. He's the kind of guy, if somebody walked up to him and said, "Oh, Les, Mr. Paul, I think it's so wonderful that you invented the electric guitar." Well,
why, thank you.
He didn't invent the electric guitar. No way. He didn't invent the solid body electric guitar.
No.
But if someone wanted to give him credit for that, he would say, just like he'd say, "Well, thank you."
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, it would take too long to explain. I understand that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of people didn't. They would say, "Oh, he's just trying to aggrandize himself." Well,
maybe he had an ego. A little bit, but,
you know,
yeah,
but like Dizzy Dean once said, it ain't bragging if you've done it.
If you've done it.
There you go.
Well, all right. And it's not bragging all the accomplishments that Michael has had over the years. This will be some of the stuff that you'll be able to hear him talk about, and probably much more besides, on the first Music Monday of the Ozarks event in June, which commemorates their move from a noontime event to a 6 p.m. event. This will be 6 p.m. on Monday, June the 3rd, University Plaza Hotel in the John Q. Hammond's room, with refreshments provided. And as always, Music Monday is free and open to the public, but they do enjoy and can make good use of donations, because that's what keeps the organization going. You can visit MusicMondayOfTheOzarks.com or their Facebook page. Both have a lot of good information about the organization. Are your videos still on YouTube?
Well, the videos are on the website.
You have links on the website.
They are on YouTube, too, but we do keep them on the website, which we've done so that, like I said, once we open our kiosk and do it, it'll be at the Springfield Historic Museum, which is the Fox Theater. And like we said, yes, donations have helped a lot. It's what's got us cameras and things like this, and keep us attuned to the latest technologies, and it helps us keep going and stuff.
And Springfield has such a worthy musical history of being recorded and archived.
Yes.
You know, so I encourage anyone who has heard about Music Mondays but never attended one, you ought to give it a shot, because I've been to many of the presentations, and there hasn't been a boring one yet. They're all just, you learn things, and it just kind of makes you proud.
To be here, to be a part of this area.
Like I said, we've got, we're going to bring in Rosemary Jackson, who Randy knows, who helped start the Springfield Opera. We've got a dedication for Jim Wonderly, who was very vital to this situation.
Yes.
And Larry Lee will be with us, and we're talking to Randy Hamm, who heads up the
Studies program here at MSU.
KSMU.
Yeah, and does his program
just
here.
Keep go to Facebook, and you'll find who we're having our next guest on, and
the date.
Like I said, we've got quite a few people lined up for the rest of the year.
All right, that is Chris Albert, who is the vice president of Music Monday of the Ozarks, and Michael Cochran, who will be the guest speaker for their June 3rd Music Monday presentation at the new time of 6 p.m. at University Plaza. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. I don't usually allot this much time in these arts news interviews, but I wasn't about to jump in and say, nope, all right, you're out of time.
You're very skillful.
Yeah, thank you very much, Randy, and thank you, KSMU.
As an old radio dog, I can say Randy is a very skillful interviewer.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
And thank you. It's an honor to be here with you.
Yes, it is.
Appreciate it.
It is.